Our meeting format calls for a guest speaker followed by open discussion. Our guest speaker will share for 30 to 45 minutes before calling on people to share. It is now my pleasure to introduce tonight's chairperson, Leonard from Fresno, with 26 years.
Yes. Fresno, well, my name's Leonard and I'm an alcoholic.
Leonard.
Very grateful to be in another meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. First time I heard someone say that when I was getting sober, I thought you are a liar because I was just beginning to come to terms with the fact that I was an alcoholic and I was not happy about it or grateful about it. But I can honestly say that I am truly grateful to be an alcoholic. In the past, I've tried to keep myself from talking too much about, you know, what it was like. We all have drunk logs, and I really, really want to focus. I think we have 30 to 45 minutes, so, you know, stay focused on, what happened and what it's like now. So I started drinking at the age of 16, alcoholically. My first drunk was when I was 13. It was at a hall out in the country. It was at my sister's wedding reception, and someone had a great idea about leaving, you know, a 13-year-old in charge of the bar so they could go out and dance, and so I just helped myself, and that was my first drunk. I did things that immediately I was embarrassed about, especially the next day, when what I used to hate over the years was the question, do you know what you did last night? You know, and I would shiver at what it was that I could remember, and what I try to fish out information from what I couldn't remember. So at 13 years old, a pimply-faced kid, you know, that first feeling of alcohol completely was a spiritual experience for me because, you know, as an insecure 13-year-old kid, I identified with what Bill wrote about. And Bill was a prolific writer, and he's had so many essays and things he's written for us. But he said, for him, about that the effect of the first drink, he said that strange barrier that separated me from all other men and women seemed to instantly disappear. And so I you know, at that reception, I tried hitting on the drummer. She was it was a couple, and you know, I was trying to make conversation with her while she was playing, and but you know, kind of jumping to when I was 16, that's when I started getting some independence, and I got my license, and I wasn't under the constant, you know, supervision of my parents, and I really went out and started pretty early. Started showing signs of alcoholism early as I look back on my drinking, you know, that the normal drinkers normally, you know, don't black out, right? But I started doing that, you know, at a very early age. And again, the question always, do you know what you did last night? And I would try to laugh stuff off. You know, I would try to make jokes about it, you know, like when I wrecked my mom's car in high school, and I one time I nicked a bridge, another time I took out some vines at the side of her car. And I thought, well, I'll just kind of, you know, make a joke about it. And she came in, you know, and I passed out on the couch, and she comes in and on our pleather couch, and she goes, what are you doing in here? And I said, well, Mom, I got some good news and I got some bad news. I said, the good news is you get that new paint job you always wanted for your car. She goes, what? I said, you know, and I wrecked your car. And so she went out, and I would, my sense of humor, even today, wasn't all that funny, right? But it was just a way to try to get out of, divert the attention or try to make it, you know, not seem so bad. And so as I was getting in high school and I would do other goofy things, one time these guys, we went to a friend's house and he had a black lab, right? And they said, do you know what you did last night? You sat there and you spoke this like foreign language to this dog, and you were just sitting there going, bleh, bleh. And the dog was sitting there just kind of looking at you, and And of course, I wanted to try to divert that and kind of laugh it off. And I said, "Well, yeah," I said, "but you know, that should impress you, because you know, being able to speak Black Lab is a much harder dialect than speaking Golden Lab." So you know, it was a way to kind of like not take responsibility and just. But I used to cringe at what it was that people said, and they told me that I did. And the more I did that kind of stuff, I'd just be more embarrassed about it. I got married very young, at the age of 19. My girlfriend came up and said, "You know, we're pregnant." And so I said, "Well, I guess you need to get married." So we did get married. I was had no clue as to what it meant to be a responsible man, a husband, right? I didn't know what that meant. I just knew that was what, you know, the honorable thing to do, and so that's what you do. Because I wasn't finished drinking, and my wife was kind of more subdued and permissive, and she said, "Oh, you can go out with the guys, you know." And I would go out, and I was ripping and running and doing my own thing. And by the time we had our second child, you know, that was, you know, in 2 years, we had kids that were 8 days shy of a year from being a year apart. So I got all the waiting recovery room jokes and stuff. But, you know, we had a very young family early, but I wasn't done, and not even close. And I put my wife and my kids through a whole bunch. I had a number of alcohol-related accidents. And starting from high school all the way to the end of my drinking, I was pulled over a number of times or whatever. Came from a small community town, not too far from here. And so my family was known. We weren't famous or, you know, rich or anything like that. But the people knew my parents, and they respected them. And they let me off. The cops let me off the hook every time. I was dead in the water. They would not do this kind of stuff today. But one time, it's like we just made a beer run, and we had open containers on the ground, and they just said, "Whose car is this?" I said, "It's mine. I just got this car." Said, "The alcohol that's on the floor, dump it out. Put those in your trunk. Put all this beer from the beer run into the back of the police car." And I thought they were doing me a favor. They probably just had a big party afterwards. But I was never incarcerated. Never. That happened all the way throughout my drinking, and it happened a number of times. Toward the end of my drinking, I got pulled over by a sheriff, and he just came on, and it was, this is how crazy stupid my thinking is. I used to love the fog and driving in the fog, because I figured the cops couldn't see me. And I can remember, and I worked in Fresno, and I, you know, would drive home to Kingsburg by way of Exeter or Lemoore, and I would sit there and I'd drink and drive, and I was, you know, an unguided missile. One time I came out of, I ended up in some bar in Exeter, and I was sitting there, came out of a blackout. I look at my speedometer, it says 80 miles an hour. I look up, and it's a white sheet of fog, and I blacked out again, and I came to at home. So I was lucky I didn't kill somebody or kill myself, you know. So by the time I came into AA, my relationships were bad. I have always had relationships, but when I got here, they were pretty bad. My wife and I were not very close. My kids really didn't want to be around Dad. They were in their, like, 15. So they'd seen a lot, and they'd had to go through a lot. And I was a crazy man. I would rage at them, and why the hell were you on the phone? I was trying to call home, and kind of, you know, a bully, you know. And that's impacted them. You know, even today, I have a 41-year-old daughter, and the effects of that are still there. I've made my amends. I've done all of that. But I can't. I have to let her walk her path and still be there when she's ready, and just love her as best I can. My son understood. He completely remembers when I made my amends to them. My daughter, for some reason, I did it twice. She doesn't remember. But that's, you know, in God's time, you know. So when I came into AA, I came in like December of 93. I'm sorry, 95, and I came in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I can remember how that felt. I got here, And I thought, you really sunk. You're here in this room where you used to buy your liquor across the street, and you used to look at those people walking around with, you could see the little glow of the cigarettes moving all around, and you think, you know, I remember saying, oh, those poor bastards, you know, and here you are, you're, you know, here in the rooms of AA, you got a vomit on your shirt, you know, you're sitting there, and I can remember being in that room and just feeling just totally empty. You know, I just empty. And I described it early in sobriety, and I look back on it, and it's I felt like a walking tomb. I felt like a tomb is, you know, you could paint a tomb up on the outside and make it look really nice, but on the inside, still a dead person. That's how I felt, and that's how I described it. I felt like I was a walking dead person, and incomprehensible demoralization, you know. Come to find out over time that was a blessing. But I jump a little too far ahead. So I was going to meetings, and I stayed sober for a few days, and it was about 3 or 4 days. And then I started listening to these people sharing. And I can remember thinking, well, I didn't sleep under the bridge. You know, I didn't sit on the curb when drinking out of a paper bag. You know, I didn't live in the Oleanders along the freeway. And in very short order, I was drinking again because I was not listening for any similarities. I was listening for differences. I'm not like you guys. Right? I'm different. Right? So I was drinking again. I said, this is stupid, going to AA meetings and drinking. So I went out and drank again for another 6 months until alcohol brought me back. And, you know, when I came back that next time, I came back by way of a treatment center. I went to a treatment center, and I was really glad I went there because they were good. And I think back on what they shared with me right off the bat. They said, we're not going to get you sober. We're going to teach you a little bit about the disease of alcoholism. We're going to teach you a little bit about yourself. We're going to look in your family history. You know, we're going to look at different things, but you're going to get sober in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. And here, by the way, go and take this Get Well card and get it signed 3 meetings a week. And immediately I said, and I'd already signed all the documents, I said, I can't do that. I'm busy. I got stuff to do. I've got commitments and blah, blah, blah. And immediately they said, the guy said, you said you would be willing to do whatever it took to get sober, didn't you? And I said, yeah, I did. He said, okay. He said, I suggest you get this signed. And there's a meeting going on right now. I had gone to sign myself in. I snuck away from work. And when I got there, we did all the paperwork. He goes, now I want you to go to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous at Fresno Fellowship, and it's so-and-so. I said, I can't, immediately, I can't do that. I got to get back to work. He said, you said you'd be willing to do whatever it took to get sober. And I said, I did. And so I took off. I went to that meeting. I sat there, I was all nervous. And it was at Fresno Fellowship when it was like, you know, across the room. It was like ghost silhouettes because there was so much smoke in the room. And I got out of there and I went back to work. And I thought, man, they're going to smell this on me. And all the smoke. So I got in there and I asked my coworker. I said, hey, did anybody miss me? He goes, no. He goes, no, nobody asked about me or anything? I said, no. So I was in that treatment program. I immediately had a family function, and I come from a very heavy drinking family. That's not what makes me an alcoholic. And so one guy said, I suggest that you find out, before you even unpack your bags down in L.A., find central office, find out where meetings are going at the same time, and if you get squirrely, get out of there. And so I did that, and I went to the meeting because I was feeling really uncomfortable in there, and I took off, and I made arrangements. My wife was going to ride back to the hotel with another family member, and I got back. And before she did, and she came in, and I said, hey, I want to go. She goes, oh, it's good. And she goes, I said, hey, did anybody miss me? She said, no. I said, nobody asked about me? She said, no. And it hit me that I'm not the center of everybody's, you know, thoughts or, you know, actions. people have their own stuff that they're worried about. But it kind of offended me that nobody missed me. You know, I want to be at the center of attention. I don't want responsibility. I just want to be at the center of attention. So that was kind of an introduction to, you're not all that special. You know, it was an introduction to the reality that I was extremely Leonard-centered, right? and self-absorbed and immature. And, in that treatment program, one of the counselors, he caught me on a number of things. He kind of caught my tendency to hide and lie. And so he goes, so here's my story. He said, so Leonard, so, did you, he said, do you hide your drinking? I said, no. He said, what about when you drive home and you go a different route? You stop at the different stores, your excursion to get back home. He goes, that's not hiding, you're drinking? I said, no, I just like to go different routes, you know. He goes, huh. He said, how about when you are driving home and you stuff, empties under your seat and, He said, that's not hiding your drinking? I said, no. I said, that's freaking prudent. I mean, you would not want to have open containers on the floorboard if a cop pulls you over. You know, that's stupid, you know. He said, that's not hiding your drinking? I said, no. He goes, huh. Then he said, well, how about when you come home and your wife asks you how much you drink and you tell her two, but you don't tell her that they're two quarts of split malt liquor, which is a six-pack. He said, that's not hiding your drinking? Okay. He was becoming less sure of my answers. I said, no. He goes, huh. He goes, what about that backyard where you have the refrigerator and stuff? I said, hey, I emptied all that out. He goes, are you sure, Leonard? He said, you don't have any alcohol in your house. I said, no, I got none. He goes, think. And I sat there and I thought, I said, oh, you know what, I got a case of champagne. But it was for a function we had and, to a group I belonged to. And he goes, huh. And he said, any other alcohol? I said, no. He says, none. I said, no. He goes, oh, I said, wait, in that refrigerator, I got one silver bullet left in there, one Coors Light. He goes, I think it's really sick that someone who's in a treatment program for alcoholism has alcohol in their house still. And he caught me and he said, you ever hear the story of Superman? I said, well, yes, of course, everybody's heard the story of Superman. He says, do you remember what it was that rendered Superman powerless? And I said, yeah, it's kryptonite. He goes, you think Superman has a 12-ounce can of kryptonite in his refrigerator in his backyard? And I started laughing. And he kind of was pulling my covers. And he said, and you know what? He says, and that's right. And he's Superman, and you're just Leonard. I needed people to start pulling my covers and, the lying that I would do. And I had to start seeing myself through somebody else's eyes. And because my sponsor ended up telling me, your perceptions are distorted, Leonard. Your perceptions are screwed up. Okay, we're going to work on that. He said, more will be revealed. He goes, yeah, just keep coming back, more will be revealed. He said, God would not disclose to you everything about yourself in one shot. Right? Because he's too gentle. He says, if he did that to you, it would crush you. And so, my sponsor was pretty good at, kind of summing things up and kind of having me look at things from a different perspective. He said a lot of things that bothered me or hurt my feelings a little bit at times. But I got to understand that I needed to have someone to not BS me, to not coddle me, right? Because I'll want to take the easier, softer way, you know. So I was very grateful to be able to have people that were willing to level with me. One of the things that counselor in that treatment program said, he said, so when did you start drinking alcoholically? You know, think about it. And I said, well, you know, when I started getting, you know, my license and disappearing, you know, and wrecking. And so probably 16 years old. He goes, okay. He said, so you're a 16-year-old emotional dwarf. I said, what? He goes, yeah, you're 36 years old chronologically, and that might not be politically correct, but that's what he shared with me. He said, yeah, he said, you are emotionally a 16-year-old. He said, so, but keep coming back and work on sobriety, he says, and you will start eventually over time, your emotional maturity will start to catch up to your chronologic age. And but I was offended when he said that. In fact, I was pissed off. And he you know, it's like, who are you? But he was another one of those guys that could make me laugh at myself. I got a sponsor. I went back to the meetings, and I heard those guys that were in those meetings again. Same people, you know. Slept in the oleanders, you know, along the freeway. Slept under a bridge. Sat on the street with a paper bag, drinking out of a paper bag. And I knew, without reservation, that was me. I didn't do those things, but I knew without reservation that was me. I just needed more alcohol and more time, and that was me. There was no difference between me and them. I've got to understand that, and that's what I love about AA. It doesn't matter how much time you got here. There's no difference spiritually, very little, between any of us. You know, we're equals here, okay? So there's no AA gurus, right? We dispel the notion of AA gurus. But there are people that do have more experience and more sobriety that can help us. You know, I don't care how long. I love hearing some of the stuff that newcomers will share. I mean, I remember one newcomer sharing something that I just loved. He goes, you know, my twisting, my thinking is all messed up. He said, don't try to cure your own sick head with your own sick head. And I love that because, you know, that's how my thinking was when I got here. And I had to start letting go of what I thought I needed to do and turn that over to somebody else. And I had to be willing to get sober somebody else's way. Because Leonard's way got me into the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. My best effort to try to live life got me here. You know, so it's like, you know, in a couple of years into sobriety, I went back to school. You know, they say not to make any big changes or whatever. 2 months into sobriety, I went back to school. I went into completing 40 units in 13 months through. And it was crazy. And then I had some gap units I needed to make up. So I was busy with school, but I kept what they told me, keep sobriety first. And I would get, you know, the first week, you got to read 400 pages out of, 200 out of this book, 100 out of this book, 100 out of this, you know. They had all these assignments, and you had to come ready and be prepared because it was a non-traditional program, and they could tell if you weren't ready. Because your group who you were assigned to, you wouldn't perform, and you held your group down. So there was accountability there. So I went to school. I kept sobriety first. I was thinking, how am I ever going to get this done? I got all of this. Next week would come. Oh, man, how am I ever going to get this done? And about the sixth week, it's like, oh, how am I ever going to get this done? And the thought came, it's like, you've already done it for 6 weeks. Shut up and do it. Just trust what's going on here and just suit up and show up. Take the suggestions. They taught me how to read quickly. I'm a slow reader. I don't have really good comprehension. But they taught me how to do, you know, use tools that to be able to be successful. And I went from being if you should see my transcripts, all the withdrawals and incompletes and Fs, but I went from that to being on the Distinguished Achievement Award for my cohort. That was something that occurred because I was sober, I was focused, I was starting to live life doing things differently, and it was tough. So my first... how much time do I have, Bill?
10 minutes.
Okay. So, you know, I went back to school. I became a teacher in sobriety. I remember it as I was going to have to take a physical, and I said, "Oh, they're going to ask about that drug thing, alcohol thing." Then, sure enough, there was on there, and I toyed with the idea of lying, but I thought, "I'm not going to lie," so I put it down. And the doctor looked at me and goes, "Huh, you had a problem with alcohol?" I said, "Yeah, I'm a recovered alcoholic, doc." And he goes, "Huh, how long?" I said, 4 years. He goes, "Huh, good for you." Wrote, and that was it. So working on that rigorous honesty, even when it was kind of uncomfortable, was something that, I needed to learn how to do. I love being a grandfather. I became a grandfather at about 11 years of sobriety. And our grandson, we weren't real excited when we heard that our daughter was going to have a baby right then at that, but we got used to it pretty quickly. And so, he comes along, she's about ready to deliver. We're in the hospital. Me and the other grandpa are sitting there in the waiting room and get a phone call. He's here. And my wife called me. She said, "Come on in. You can come in now." My wife had been with my daughter through the delivery, and so I went in, and there she is standing with them. My daughter's tired. She had a really hard labor, and so, but there's my wife beaming, and she has this little bologna loaf in her arms, and she goes, "Here he is." And I walked over, and I looked at him, and I had known he was coming, et cetera. As soon as she put him in my arms, I cannot describe to you the lightning bolt of joy that I felt in that moment. It was powerful for me. And I was trying to tell people, I was trying to tell my Nina, I called it my godparents, "Hey, this is..." I'm stumbling all over my words, and she stopped me. She goes, "Mijo," she goes, "there is a joy that God has only reserved for grandparents." And that was it. Enough said. She knew exactly what I was talking about. But I have felt, I love being a grandpa. We have four. The oldest one, that little one, is now 16. We have two twin grandsons and a 6-year-old granddaughter, 7-year-old granddaughter. I love spending time with them, and they love. If I had been drinking, none of that would be there. If I were even alive, if I were alive and still drinking, that would not be there. I know that. And our first grandson was born, like I mentioned, and he couldn't do anything wrong. My brother, I was holding him, at a family thing, and my brother came up to me. He goes, "Man, you're messed up." He goes, "You're messed up." I said, "What do you mean?" He goes, "There's just something about you. You're messed up. I was just loving on this kid." At about 4 or 5 months, he started, I'd take him and I'd have him look at the aquarium, and he was, he would just sit there and be mesmerized. And then one time he was sitting there in his bassinet, and he's going like this. And I said, "He wants to go to the aquarium." And my wife looked at me, she goes, "How do you know?" I said, "I don't know, I just know." So we're still standing there looking at him, and he's sitting there going, and all of a sudden he just goes, "Arr!" And he just tightened up, and I said, "He wants to go." So I picked him up, and man, he was happy. And my wife said, "How'd you know that?" And I said, because I've been a teacher of kids with special needs, and I'm listening to them with a lot of nonverbal communication that they have. And I think I was able to intuit what he needed.
Wow.
So he couldn't do nothing wrong. 2 years, fast forward 2 years, and he's learning to crawl around, and he is having to learn the word no. So he gets up and he climbs up to this cheap TV stand we had. He goes up to this flat screen. He goes, "Whack! Whack!" And this thing starts going like this. And then I thought, oh no. So he turns around, he looks at me, he's all happy. He turns around, he looks, I said, "Ah, ah, ah, ah," like that. And I just crushed him. His face dropped, he fell on the ground, he threw himself back, and he just starts bawling. It's like, that was the first tantrum I saw him have. I mean, he would cry and stuff, but this was something he wanted to get his way. And he's sitting there, no tears, just raging and screaming. And he'd look at me, and he'd see me looking. We'd meet, our eyes would meet, and he'd start screaming louder. And he's sitting there, and I'm looking at him, and I'm thinking, how cute is that? He's trying to get his way. He can't do it. I'm not going to let that thing fall on him. He's trying to get his way by raging and being, you know, just going off. It's what he knows, to try to get what he wants. And I remember thinking, you know what? I love him. No matter, I don't care how he's acting, I love him. And if it had been my kid way back, hey, knock that, I'll give you something to cry about, kind of thing.
Right?
But I thought, I just love this guy. And I was sitting in that moment thinking about that. And people can say what they want, but I wasn't a voice like I'm talking to you right now. It wasn't, you know, loud or profound. It was just this voice inside of me. And it said, that's how I have loved you. Mm-hmm. No matter how many ways I've thrown my tantrum and tried to get my way and get God to do what I wanted them to do, he just loved me. And that was a deep, profound understanding of my higher power. That a tiny child with an imperfect grandpa was able to teach me about the love that a perfect creator has for his imperfect children. That makes sense to me. I'm so grateful to be alive. I'm so grateful for the life that I get to live today. To work on trying to be in service. I wouldn't trade it for anything. I've won the lottery. I played the lottery, but I've already won the lottery, right? I get to live in sobriety. I live free from the compulsion to drink. I can go anywhere and be amongst drinking and stuff. It does not bother me. So I have a freedom today, and I'm grateful for that. Thanks for listening.
I forgot. My name's Kelly. I'm an alcoholic.
Hey, Kelly.
I got my glasses, you guys. So, we'll now start the discussion part of this meeting. We would like to hear from as many people as possible, so please limit your sharing to allow for this. I will turn the speaker, or turn the meeting back over to the speaker, or the chairperson, would you mind asking a couple questions? Okay, we have time for a few questions. Go ahead.
How long did it take for the emptiness to go away with that feeling? Where did it take?
When I came...
Hey, Leonard, could you repeat the question?
Yes.
The microphone.
Okay, yes. How long did it take for the emptiness to go away, that gut-wrenching emptiness? It came on the second time after I came back in, right? And because that is chronic. It was with me all the time. I could be in the room next to my wife, you know, going to sleep, and I could be 100 miles away from her emotionally, right? But by coming to AA and continuing, I started to develop some hope in here. I'd listen to people's stories. And I knew you guys were telling the truth because you were talking about and laughing about stuff that I did that I wasn't telling anybody. And I never thought I would tell anybody, you know, but you'd laugh about stuff like that, you know, and some of the more milder ones, you know, do normal drinkers drive down the road with one eye closed and try so they only see one set of lines on the road? And, no, then normally they probably don't do that. So I was able to start laughing and living again. And that, you know, by being in the rooms of AA and being open to listening, that when I came back that time and starting to connect with other alcoholics and to not look at you. To when I first came in here, you guys are weird. And when I got here again, it's like, I'm one of you. I'm weird, right? And to be able to come in touch with who I am, and over time, especially by virtue of working the steps and staying close to a sponsor who was guiding me and helping me along, those feelings of inadequacy, emptiness, loneliness, I no longer had ideations of suicide, those left. And it's by God's grace that it happens, but it took my willingness to cooperate with that grace and show up and do what I needed to do here. Yeah, good question.
Go ahead.
You said that you've never been in.
You know, people, I came from a religious background, and I had this feeling of guilt all the time, and it was kind of like crushing, and I was felt guilty because a lot of times I was really guilty, but I'm sorry, I did not repeat the question. And the question was again, help me out so I can repeat it. What led me to the point of making a decision to get into treatment?
Yeah.
And I would have this fear of, because of my behavior and history, when I would come home after, I'd go outside and have to walk around in the garage because I was starting to have this immense fear that I had killed somebody. And I would look and see, you know, I had this fear that I was going to have a kid's bike impaled on my grill and not know what happened. And so all of this stuff started happening, and I needed to. So what's really kind of interesting about your question about never being incarcerated but finally coming to is that, you know, I never was incarcerated, but I'm on H&I and go work in hospitals and institutions, so I go into jail frequently. You know, to carry a message of hope to those inmates that are there. And so I needed to come into AA in order to start going to jail.
That works.
Oh,
I didn't hear, I could be wrong, I didn't hear anything about the 12 steps. Do you work the steps? Do you, what's your opinion on them?
Oh, yeah. Question is he didn't hear anything about the 12 steps in my share. And probably when I'm thinking about a lot of things, absolutely the 12 steps are what I needed to do in order to start becoming honest and start dealing with all of the crud that was inside.
Right.
You know, the 12 steps are a way of life for me. It's a blueprint for living, as the big book talks about it. You know, it's a way to be able to really... not only not drink, but to live life.
Yeah.
You know? And the 12 steps, I apologize for not talking about that, but absolutely, you know, getting here, getting a big book, reading the big book, getting a sponsor, working the steps. I ended up working my fifth step with my sponsor at 18 months after coming in here. It took me a while because I said I got, you know, busy, but I kept working on it. And so by the time I called my sponsor, he said, "Leonard, I've been waiting for this call." And, so we got together and spent quite a bit of time going over it, doing that house cleaning. This is an inside job here, you know. And you know, what I love about the 12 steps is that someone kind of just and I liked it, but you know, look at the first three steps and it's about, you know, giving up, you know, surrendering to alcohol, giving up, you know, my way of living, finding a power greater than myself. So giving up and then going through the process of cleaning up, you know, and taking inventory. And then, you know, the next steps, working on making up with my higher power as well as those around me. And then finally, the final three, the 10th and 10 and 11, kind of a continuation of what I've done from 1 through 9, because that continues on. It's not a one and done thing.
Yep.
It's a way of life. And then, you know, roll in, you know, the 12th step, and that's, you know, carrying the message. So kind of think about it. It's giving up, cleaning up, making up, and growing up.
Wow. Nice. I like that. That's really good. Thank you for your share. Where does your meditation come into play throughout the day?
Where does my meditation come in throughout the day? I start very simply in my mornings. My meditation, my prayer, I should say, is immediately, you know, God, use me. In fact, I prayed it before I started. You know, use me as you see fit for your good purposes this day.
Wow.
Very simple. And then so the meditation part, That's like if you're in a conversation and you're talking and it's all one-sided, that's not a conversation. So the meditation part is the listening. So I get to talk and pray, and then I need to be quiet. And I need to listen. And honestly, I don't hear God's voice, you know, like I heard one minister say, he says, if you hear God's voice talking to you as loud as I'm talking to you, you better check your medication. but you know, it's whatever works for you. But for the most part, my meditation is just silent, being still. And I have had some kind of inspirations or a thought or, you know, that kind of thing come during those times. To talk about meditation and intuition, my sponsor was dying of cancer, and he would stay up at night and he'd pray, and because of the medication he couldn't sleep, and so he'd write things and he'd send them to me or to us, and one day I was really mad at my daughter, and I was writing this text to him in the morning right before work, you know, something that she had done that I was offended, you know, and I was just going at it, and I get a text from him. And it says, all you have to do is tell your daughter that you love her. It's like, what the heck? So I dial him up. I said, hey, Tom, I'm just composing this text to you about, you know, my daughter. And he goes, I know. He says, I intuited that you needed to hear that. And so prayer and meditation is a big part of what my sponsor showed me in his life. And to be able to do that. So meditating... I still practice my faith today. My sponsor, I was about ready to toss out everything I'd learned growing up. I was doing that because I knew you guys were telling the truth and you were sober and laughing. And I had learned how to, you know, light all the candles, ring the bells and stuff. And I had this thought, talk to your sponsor. So I told him, I said, I'd like to, I'm thinking about not going to church anymore. And he goes, what? He goes, Leonard. He'd listen to me, and then he stopped me. He goes, Leonard, he said, you've been going to church all your life. Go to church if you want. AA has no problem with you going to church, but whatever you do, don't substitute church for AA, because they're not the same. And I'm glad he said that, because I continue to practice my faith today. Meditation is part of that, my faith.
My question is, what's the last time you read Upon Awakening?
Upon Awakening... I'm not sure what page that's on, but yes. Yeah. So, no, I mean, I go to big book studies. I love big book studies. I go to big book studies more so than I go to open meetings. Mm-hmm. So I read Upon Awakening. But, again, you know, with as my sobriety has gone on, you know, I get the chance to be, it has worked for me. It has worked for me. But Upon Awakening, if you don't know what he's talking about, it's in the big book. But go ahead and... 86? Thank you. And then go ahead and look at, if you're not sure what you can do to meditate or to get in touch with your higher power, that's a great suggestion.
All right.